Crispin, The Cross of Lead, Chapters 51 through 55. Chapter 51. For the rest of the day, I remained in the hiding place, thinking. In doing so, I continued to piece together the fragmentary bits of my life and place them together until they became a mosaic. I kept asking myself if I felt different, if I was different. The answer was always yes. I was no longer nothing. I had become two people, Lord Furnival's son and Crispin. How odd, I thought. It had taken my mother's death, Father Quinnell's murder, and the desire of others to kill me for me to claim a life of my own. But what kind of life? I suppose some might have considered me blessed in that I was of high blood, but I knew that blood, as Widow Daventry had said, to be nothing but venom. That Lord Furnival was my father had been but a cruel burden. Bear, in the short time I had known him, was a thousandfold more a faithful father to me. For the first time, I began to think upon John Ball's words. They made sense. For what I recalled most was his saying that no man, or woman either, shall be enslaved to any other, but stand free and equal to one another. I recalled, too, what Bear had told me, that he was a fool because he should like to be in heaven before he died. I saw it then. Bear and Ball were talking about the very word Father Quinnell had used. Freedom. Something I never had, nor did anyone in my village or the other villages through which we had passed. We lived in bondage. To be a Furnival was to be part of that bondage. As time passed in the darkness of my hiding place, the only thing I knew for sure was that Bear had helped to free me. He had given me life. Therefore, I resolved to help free him, even if it cost me that new life to do so. Please stop here and answer question one. Chapter 52. It was shortly after the church bells rang for the late afternoon vespers that the widow appeared. "I found someone to help you escape Great Wexley," she said. "You'll go tonight. The man knows a safe way over the walls. If all goes well, you'll not be seen." "But what about Bear?" "In the name of God, Crispin," she said, "you cannot help him. He's already lost." She started to leave. "Where do you think I should go?" I said. She shrugged. "Go as far away as possible. Bear spoke of going to Scotland. Perhaps out of the kingdom is best." "I don't know where Scotland is." "To the north," she said. "When will you man come?" I asked. "After Compline and curfew. Pray for clouds."
"Why?"
"It will be darker."
"Widow," I said as the woman moved to leave me, "where is the White Stag?"
"By the western gate. Why do you ask?" Not wishing to mention John Ball, whom she seemed to hate, I said, "Bear spoke of it." She smiled grimly. "I'm sure Bear, God keep him, spoke of many taverns." I fell asleep, only to waken at the sound of ringing bells. Shortly after, I heard the tramp of feet outside. Then, from some distance, came the cry, "The hour of Compline is at hand. The curfew is in force. No one may be on the streets." Not much later, the widow appeared holding a lighted lamp. "The man is here. It's time." I got up, making sure I took Bear's sack as well as his hat. I also took some of the pennies we had earned and placed them in a pocket. Lastly, I touched around my neck to make certain my leather purse was there. I did not want to leave my sole possession, the cross of lead, behind. Please stop here and answer question two. "Widow," I said, "I should pay for our lodging."
"Don't be foolish. You'll need whatever you have."
She led me down the steps. In the dimness of the empty tavern room, a man stood. He was rather small, with one shoulder higher than the other. His garb, jacket, leggings, and boots was dark. He had a scabrous face with a dirty cloth wrapped around his neck. His mouth was a narrow slit.
"God be with you," I said to him.
"And you," he said, avoiding my eyes. Widow Daventry led us to the back door. Before she reached it, she blew out the lantern. Only then did she open the door.
"The moon is full," she whispered. "Be careful. God keep you well."
"The Lord's blessings on you for your help," I returned. Impulsively, she reached out and embraced me tightly, then, with a sigh, pushed me away. I stepped into the alley. The man came close behind and shut the door behind us.
"Follow me," he said.
Without a backward look, he moved away. One foot dragged so that as he walked, he made a little scraping sound upon the ground.
I glanced up to the clear sky with its bright full moon. Ill omen or good? It occurred to me that I might never see the sun again. Please stop here and answer question 3. Chapter 53. The man who guided me did not speak as we moved along narrow alleys and lanes. Never once did we set foot on the main street. But once, when we heard the watch approaching, he slipped into an alcove. Breathlessly, we waited until they passed. It was then I said, "I need you to take me to the White Stag Tavern."
"I was told to bring you to the walls," he said.
"Show me the place, and I'll trouble you no more, and I'll pay you," I said, holding out some pennies. He put out his hand, which in the moonlight showed me he had but 3 fingers. I dropped the coins. For a moment he seemed to weigh the money.
"It's not far," he said, and limped away.
After passing through a warren of muddy lanes, we came to the head of a dark alley.
"There," said the man, pointing.
No light came from any building.
"Where?" I asked. "That building."
He gestured to the head of the alley in a narrow structure 2 stories high. I looked at it again, but when I turned back to thank the man, he'd already gone. All I could hear of him was the foot scraping in the dark. I studied the house he had pointed out. It was the moon that allowed me to make out a sign hanging over the door, which bore an image of a white stag, ghost-like, in the fair light. Not only did the building seem on the verge of collapse, it appeared completely deserted. I approached the building and rapped softly upon a stout door. There was no response. Reluctant to leave, I put my ear to the door and listened. I heard a sound within. Emboldened, I knocked again. The door creaked open. I saw no one, but a voice spoke.
"Who is it?"
"I'm Bear's apprentice," I whispered. "He's been taken." The door shut. I put my ear to the door again. I was sure I heard voices. Perhaps, I thought, they were discussing what to do. The door reopened a bit.
"What's your name?"
I was asked.
"Crispin."
"Come," someone said, even as the door swung open wide enough for me to slip within. I looked around. A small candle provided little light amidst the shadows. The room was not unlike the Green Man's, but smaller, with fewer tables and benches. I could make out 5 men. Their faces were indistinct, partly hidden with cowls, making it clear they did not wish to be recognized. Still, I had a vague sense that at least some of them were those who had gathered in the shoemaker's house earlier in the day. Please stop here and answer question 4.
"What brings you here?"
I was asked. I was sure it was John Ball who spoke. "Bear has been taken," I said.
"By whom?"
"The soldiers, the ones who came to your meeting."
"Do you know where he is?"
"He was brought to the Furnival's palace."
"Are you sure?"
"I saw him dragged in."
"God have mercy on his soul," someone else said. "They'll torture him," said another. "They'll make him give our names."
"He doesn't know them." "He won't inform on you," I said. "I'm sure he won't. He's too strong for that. He'd rather die."
"Braver and stronger men than Bear succumbed to pain," said one of the men. "And he's grown weak," the man I thought was John Ball said. "When we met a year ago, he was ready to join us in our brotherhood. Since then, he's altered his mind."
I said, "He says things are not ready."
"How would a juggler know about such matters?" someone asked.
"The man's a spy," John Ball said. "It's his business to know." To hear the revelation was to know that it was true. Only part of my surprise was that I had not thought of it out myself. Then John Ball said to me,
"Why did you come here?"
"I need to help Bear."
"You can't," said another. "The palace is too well guarded. Besides, we'll have him put in the dungeons."
"Boy," said John Ball, "Bear told me you're Lord Furnival's bastard son. You were most likely the reason our meeting was discovered. Didn't Bear turn away from our brotherhood? How can we be certain of your loyalties? If you had any sense, you would be gone by now."
"It was I who warned you before," I said. "And it was Bear who helped you escape."
There was some uneasy shifting about by the men. "He's lost his way," John Ball said angrily. "We can't endanger ourselves any further."
There were some low, if indistinct, murmurs of assent. I said, "Can someone at least guide me to the square?"
"What do you think you can do?"
I can't abandon Bear, I said.
If it's true who you are, they probably took him as bait, said someone. For you. You're doing exactly what they want.
I have to try.
One of the men came forward. I'll bring you close.
Please stop here and answer question 5.
Chapter 54. We reached the square not long after the church bells rang for matins. As soon as we arrived, the man who had guided me disappeared without a word. I looked over the square. The bright moon revealed a field of empty tables and stalls deserted by its trader swarms. All lay in uneasy silence, putting me in mind of the abandoned village where I had first met Bear. But here, at one end of the square, stood the Palace of the Furnivals. It was huge and dark, save for 2 windows on the second level. There, some dim light glimmered. Opposite, at the other side of the square, the great church rose up in all its majesty, its stained glass windows glowing faintly like the embers of a smoldering fire. As I stood and listened, I heard the sound of chanting coming from the church. Priests were at their early prayers. Their blended voices rolled across the square like a rising and falling wind. I made the sign of the cross over my heart, imploring St. Giles to guide me and help me as he had done before. Then I turned to the palace where Bear was being held. Even as I wondered if he was alive, I spied some movement by the central doors at the lower level. Shielding myself behind some deserted stalls and tables, I made my way closer to the palace. When I peeked out, I saw 2 guards standing by the main doors. One of them was leaning back. His arms were folded over his chest, his head bent down. He gave the impression of being asleep. The other guard was pacing restlessly. I crept closer and studied the building. It was quite clear that there would be no getting past the main door guards. How, then, could I possibly find a way inside? Then I recalled seeing John Aycliffe on the balcony. Perhaps the second level was not so well guarded. The problem was to get there. I moved along the square so I could examine the far side of the palace building. There, other buildings crowded in. And in the moonlight, what I discovered was that between the palace and the next building, there existed only a slight separation. It was hardly more than a crevice, not big enough for a man to squeeze into, but I was still a boy. After waiting until the restless guard moved as far away as he was likely to go, I darted forward and squeezed into the breach I'd found. It was so narrow, I went in sideways. It was too dark to see much, but I could feel around. The palace walls were jagged stone. The wall opposite was made of the same rough clay or plaster. I put down Bear's sack. If I returned, I could retrieve it. If I didn't return, it wouldn't matter. Barely able to turn about, I was like a kernel of wheat between 2 stones. I pressed my hands against the opposing wall. Using my fingertips to grasp small edges and bumps, I began to move slowly up. When high enough off the ground, I lifted my legs and pushed my feet against the walls so as to gain even more purchase. Straining every bit of the way, I could climb the walls like a spider. Exactly how long it took me to reach the balcony, I don't know. It was higher than the roof of the Stromford Church. Even when I reached the level of the balcony, I was not where I needed to be. The balcony jutted out beyond the building's walls, whereas I was lodged against the side wall. Pushing my back hard against the palace stone while my feet pressed against the clay wall, I managed to turn about. Now I was able to wedge myself securely in place, even as I freed my hands. Just beneath the balcony, a stone carving of a lion, its jagged mouth agape, protruded. By stretching one arm to the utmost, I was able to reach the beast's lower jaw. Grasping it firmly, I released the pressure of my body from the walls.
Please stop here and answer question 6.
I swung out, holding onto the lion's mouth with one hand, legs dangling high above the ground and the guards below. With my other hand, I stretched up and clutched the balcony itself. Now, I was clinging to the balcony with one hand. I moved the other hand up so that now I dangled with 2 hands. Even as I swung my feet in to gain some purchase, I hauled myself up, pulling and pulling again, until I had finally hoisted myself over the balcony railing. To my great relief, no one was there. As far as I could tell, the guards below hadn't seen me. Legs shaking from my effort, I stood on the balcony and gathered my breath. Not daring to waste any time, I hurriedly crept inside through the open balcony door. In doing so, I entered a dim and narrow hall. I neither heard nor saw anything to cause alarm. Only at the farthest end was there some feeble light. I looked about. The area into which I had come was nothing more than a shadowy entryway. I edged forward, pausing to notice doors on either side of the little hall. I set my ear to one of them. When I heard nothing, I pushed it in. In the faint moonlight that came through the high, small window, I saw only flags on wooden poles. I turned to the other door, listened, then pushed it open too. Along one wall was a rack of glaives. Another wall bore broadswords. A third held some daggers. I took up one of the daggers, then withdrew, shutting the door behind me. I now moved toward the end of the entry hall, leaned forward to peer in, and gasped. Please stop here and answer question 7. Chapter 55. Illuminated by light cast from a few all but guttered candles in wall sconces was a room of vast size. It was far bigger than any room I'd ever seen before, large enough to contain more than 100 souls. All of Stromford could have crowded in. The wooden ceiling was decorated with carved interlocking flowers and vines. Walls bore panel after panel, finely wrought, upon which painted images of saints had been set. At the very far end, just opposite where I stood, was a gigantic fireplace faced with stone and painted tiles. The dull remnants of a fire burned. Close to this hearth, on one side of the room, was what appeared to be a stairway. Before the hearth stood a massive, long table with benches and chairs. The table was littered with the heaped remains of what must have been a great feast. Bones, breads, bottles, and bowls lay scattered everywhere, as if voracious giants had gathered to dine. There were mazers and trenchers, knives and napkins, goblets, things I hardly knew and more than I could count. In the dimness, I was able to make out a number of doors set in the walls. One of these doors was open. From the room beyond, a little flickering light emerged. I went into it and moved cautiously, peeked in. I had come upon something very much like a church, but it was still a room. At first glance, the room seemed to contain nothing but gold. Gold that burned with a richness my eyes could barely absorb. These golden surfaces were encrusted with countless jewels, blue, purple, and red, which in the flickering candlelight seemed to pulse with a life of their own. All in all, it was more wealth than I ever could have imagined existed on this earth. At its far end was an altar, upon which stood a cross of gleaming gold. Before the cross were some lighted candles that brought illumination to the room. To one side of these candles were jeweled boxes, probably containing saintly relics. Please stop here and answer question 8. Spellbound by such magnificence, I stepped farther inside. It was then I saw that the walls and ceilings were covered with images of holy souls. Their deep, dark eyes gazed down on me with such penetrating grief and wisdom, I did not doubt they peered into my very heart. Then I realized that on the altar, a single image had been placed. It had been set to the other side of the candles, opposite the relic boxes. Here, within a jewel-studded frame, our glorious lady, in her flowing robes of blue, was revealed. Kneeling on the ground before her was a knight in full armor, hands clasped in prayer, his face uplifted toward the Virgin. To my utter amazement, I recognized the face of the knight. It was my own, the very one I'd looked upon in the stream when Bear had made me cut my hair and wash my face. But now, as sure as I knew anything, I realized I was looking upon the image of my father. Feeling anger and curiosity, I drew closer. The kneeling man appeared so devout, so adoring of Our Lady. Yet, I knew him otherwise, a lofty lord without kindness or caring for my mother. As for me, I doubted he had any thought at all. Just to see him in his exalted state made me know with finality that I was not him, not any part. I was myself, what I had become. Please stop here and answer question 9. Thus I sank to my knees and, putting aside the dagger, prayed that God on his throne, with my mother by his side, would judge Lord Furnival for what he truly was. I was completely absorbed when a voice behind me said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I sprang to my feet and turned about. It was John Aycliffe. Please stop here and answer question 10.